Hi there. Welcome to the Crooked Forest Podcast.
My name is Holly Noonan, and I'm here with Joe Kennedy. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks, Holly.
I'm going to start off by telling you a little bit about my story, and then I'm going to ask you a whole bunch of questions. Are you down for that?
That sounds great to me.
Okay, great. Okay, so I am a Bredesen Protocol health coach, which means I do a functional medicine protocol for reversal of cognitive decline for people who are dealing especially with what Dr. Bredesen calls the type 3 toxic type of Alzheimer's, which means you've had chemical exposures or biotoxin exposures that are impairing your brain's ability to regenerate neurons. So I came to this work because I got sick myself and saw how profound an impact it had on my brain function. I was lucky enough to get a diagnosis 4 months into an extreme health issue about 7 years ago. And it has brought me down this road that has been tragic, but also quite fascinating. So one of the things that helped me get better from having extreme chronic illness that had me bedridden when I lived in Maine was moving to New Mexico and camping in the wilderness for an entire year, sleeping in a hammock. So when I refer to environmental illness in our conversations, it refers to something that can happen to the human body that leads to a hyper sensitivity to environmental stimuli. And what specifically that means is if you walk into a building and your immune system is keyed to something that's in the indoor air, it can lead to an experience of an internal vibration and a galloping inflammation that can take you, depending on what it is, hours or days to recover from minutes of exposure. So what that meant for me was I had to basically avoid being inside buildings for years. It's an illness that made me homeless and a lot of my friends. So as I went down this road, I learned a lot about these complex chronic illnesses and why they are increasing. And it has led me to where we are now, which is a focus on healthy housing. And so this is not an intellectual, esoteric pursuit. This is really nitty gritty. This had a huge impact on my life and the life of a lot of people I love. I've had friends die from this illness because they couldn't find safe, healthy housing. And so what it's done is led me to this place of designing a whole neighborhood based on the microbiome. So an understanding how your internal biome communicates with the biome in your environment, both your micro environment, meaning inside your house, and the macro environment of your region. And so that's the pursuit that has led me to find you, Joe, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation to learn about why you got involved in this lane of academic pursuit, why you got interested in it, because as I understand it, you didn't get sick, you just got fascinated with it.
Well, I did slowly come to this field kind of through the back door, actually, in terms of my studies. And I think my interest, though, in the earth was long-standing, though. I mean, I always loved, there was a stream behind my friend's house growing up as a kid in elementary school. And I used to love digging around in there and make little holes in the banks of the stream and make little places for the crayfish to live and stuff like that. So there was a long-standing childhood connection with the earth and mud in particular, as I recall.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up back east, but the time I'm thinking of now is when I lived in suburban Maryland, outside of Baltimore, sort of the quintessential suburban living, you know, brand new houses, you know, built in those days. I probably got sick myself from that. We lived in a brand new split level. And, but it was right on the edge of the countryside. So we actually spent a lot of time outside, but it was really kind of the leading edge of suburban development in those days. So I lived in that and grew up in that, but I also saw how damaging it was too. So
Was this a time before ticks became really dangerous?
I don't know. I know that as a little kid, I think I got a tick or two, but it was before Lyme disease. This is back in like the late 60s, early 70s. And we didn't know anything about anything those days. You know, it's just the beginning of any environmental awareness. And we grew up, you know, eating our toxic cereal and liking it, you know, and to go along with our cartoons and everything. So it was not something that I actually was exposed to through any sort of uncle or aunt or anything. It was pretty much self-driven, all of this interest. But it really only became awoken really after some trips in the Sierra Nevada as a teenager after we moved to California and having the chance to be in wilderness and really experiencing a very deep connection with the earth at that time, which then was kind of like part of my DNA. And I kind of had to pursue it in whatever I did. And so when I chose architecture, sort of the way of earth architecture kind of is what emerged for me.
Did you have something of a mystical experience on that trip?
Yeah, actually, I was about 16 years old. I think I had just turned 16, and a couple of friends of mine and I wanted to go backpacking. We were into going into the mountains, growing up in California. And so we had a chance. This is more driven by a friend of mine, but we had an older family friend willing to go with us because, you know, sending three teenagers into the depths of the Sierra Nevada is a recipe for disaster, which it almost was anyway. But to make a long story short, it was 2 weeks of a mystical experience in the mountains where we had to, you know, literally death-defying stuff and climbing up, you know, 90-foot sheer cliffs with the storm behind us and, you know, all of this really something beyond the scope of our conversation today, but hugely impactful on me, something I'm continuing to unpack, and was, you know, really the spiritual juice that I got as a teenager that kind of sent me a whole other direction in my life that I'm still on, and not something I anticipated or anything. You know, it was really like the earth teaching me directly. There wasn't any sort of religious intercession, if you will.
It was more direct.
Very direct. And so I've been luckily enough able to pay attention and remember and continue to kind of explore it in my own way over the last, gosh, that was 45 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And it still influences me today. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting path I've been on for sure. And it's led me now to Silver City, and a lot of what I've studied now is coming useful after a long time of not, you know, kind of being a voice in the wilderness, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Even in California, because we think about California as being progressive on topics like this, but you feel like you're a little bit more welcomed with your skill set here in Silver City?
Well, natural building and quote unquote green building have a somewhat unequal relationship. Green building is kind of the difference between the raw and the cooked, if you will. And the cooked building in the ecological realm is manufactured products and things that you can buy and stuff that is oftentimes quite expensive. And then you have the raw, which is people digging up the dirt in their yard and making earth bricks and using poles from the land and stones that are non-worked and things like that. So there's been these two kind of traditions in the ecological building world that I've been part of both, in fact.
Okay. So the earthen buildings is the one that I'm specifically interested in, the raw ones that you're talking about, because they actually are actively, they're an active biome, a microbiome, microbially active. In a way that the cooked versions of what you're describing, what you're saying is there are sustainably sourced timber and green drywall and basically conventional building supplies that are on the green side of the spectrum of the supply chain.
Right.
But that's not what we're talking about for the project that we're working on now. We're really focusing on the earth-based buildings. Is that right?
Well, what's interesting is there is some overlap between pure earth and something that's manufactured. And that's actually the overlap that I'm most interested in right now. But getting back to your question, the earth has been a building material for millennia. And it was really the first manufactured material, I believe, as a species that we made in terms of making initial mud bricks, even just what are called puddled adobes, where you just take the mud and you make a rough oblong. And those can be stacked up and were and led to buildings that are still around in the Middle East these days.
How old are they?
Gosh, you know, I think 6,000 years old is some of the oldest stuff. So way before.
I was shocked to read this statistic in your book, Builders Without Borders, that 1/3 of the 8 billion people that live on this planet live in earth houses.
Well, I have to say that that figure may have been accurate when I wrote it, but earth architecture is 20 years ago now. Earth architecture has been under attack for decades. And unfortunately, in the areas where it's most prevalent, it's also most denigrated now in terms of people not wanting the old ways of building. So
what's the attack about?
It's about the perception of being old or old fashioned. A lot of it's perceptual. And having a kind of a concrete block house is a symbol of progress and making it, especially in Africa. And so there's an association with earth building of, oh, that's my grandfather's building, and that's not for me. Mm-hmm. I'm part of this new modern era that I want to move into. So the symbolic value of concrete and cement, even though it's uncomfortable, even though it's expensive, goes beyond reason. And so we have these kind of insane situations where something that makes a lot of sense is being dismissed.
Well, I got to say, I think the time is coming around again to this because people like me, there's tens of thousands of people like me who have environmental illness, and we're looking at buildings like the Taos Pueblo that has been continuously inhabited for 1,000 years by people who are healthy. And I'm looking around going, why are we doing anything other than that?
Well, it's a very good question. And part of it is that it's very difficult to monetize mud. It is cheap as dirt and is available to a lot of people in a do-it-yourself sort of fashion. And so is of not interest to our, you know, overall capitalist system.
That's right. It's really perhaps, you said it's under attack. I think it's probably a combination of that and being, you know, having resources bled away from it, something mm-hmm. that makes so much sense, is so empowering to people, but it does not drive our economy. It does not drive our supply chain systems, the building industry, the insurance industry,
which is a kind of a shame because it is something that could be turned into as high tech of a product as anything, really. And I was very enthusiastic to learn about the progress in this regard in Europe, where earth is treated as an engineering material. It's not treated as some substandard stuff. It's actually respected for its materials properties, which are quite significant, as you found out with its biome, supporting qualities. It's a living material, but it also has thermal mass, it has compressive strength, it has beauty, it has all sorts of other aspects, which are what drew it to me in the first place. You know, the health-giving qualities were something that I became aware of later. But really, for me, it was an aesthetic. And just coming across earthen buildings for the first time and touching them and feeling them and kind of realizing that, wow, this came out of the dirt right under my feet and is turning into a building that I can be inside. There was something very primal and powerful about that.
Oh, yeah.
Even as a kid, coming across and becoming interested in architecture, there were some adobe buildings in San Diego where I grew up as a teenager, And I just loved being inside of those buildings. And they were kind of rare because Adobe doesn't work so well in earthquake areas. But here in New Mexico, without earthquakes, it works great. And because of the thermal qualities here in New Mexico, the thermal mass of Adobe and earth building makes a lot of sense here, which is why the tradition is so prevalent here.
What do you think needs to happen for us to start dealing with earth as an engineering material here, not just in Europe, but here?
Well, luckily, there are codes that are being developed now, and New Mexico does have an earth building code. There are others that are being developed in various parts of the world that we can look to. But slowly but surely, Cobb, for example, is an earth building technique that's gone through a long journey of coming to a certain level of acceptance, and most recently was accepted into the International Residential Code with certain ways of practice, because the biggest worry for people, which rightly so, is that people will build improperly and dangerously. And especially with earth, and especially with earth and domes and vaults, which are of great interest, you have to be super careful. And, you know, there have been, you know, incidents that give us pause. So just because we can be enthusiastic about a material doesn't make it magical. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So we have to be very, you know, conscientious about how we move forward. So that is one part of the answer to your question. But luckily there has been progress by a lot of thankless work by a lot of people over the years. And there are global gatherings and national gatherings too that speak about progress in the earth building world. So it's kind of a little bit forward and backwards. But in fact, we know more about earth building now than we ever have. And the traditions have been brought back to life in many ways from a dead language of building to something that's living again, which is quite exciting to have been part of.
Oh, that's amazing. So you went to some gathering in France, I think Lyon, France, in 2016, a United Nations Earth.
Well, it was called the World Congress. It's not associated with the United Nations, okay. But it is driven by the largest global earth building organization called Crater, which is based in France. And France has a long-standing earth-building tradition, especially around Lyon. And so they have these congresses every 4 years, I think since 1972. And so it's really the opportunity for anybody involved with earth-building globally to get together and speak about it.
I'd love an excuse to go back to France. Are we going to have another one?
Well, they have it in different countries every time. And so I'm not sure when the next – I think – because of COVID, I'm not sure if this most recent one got canceled or not. It was supposed to be in Iran, actually. But they happen all over the world, so I'm not sure where the next one's going to be. But I did have a chance to go. I presented there on the history of natural building in the U.S. up until, well, really starting in 1994 is when I really considered the birth of the modern natural building movement to have begun. Okay. There had been some efforts certainly prior to that, but I think as sort of a movement or people coming together, not just earth building, but straw building and bamboo and all the other natural building techniques that are out there all came together starting in 94. And that's when I became aware of all of the different variety of earth building techniques there were. There's Adobe, there's Cobb, there's rammed earth, there's compressed earth blocks, there's earth bags, there's Waddle and Daub, there's this, there's that. There's a number of different things that have been developed in different regions over the world. And to learn about them all was super interesting. It's like, I don't know, I'm like a cook who likes all the ingredients. I don't want to just like be limited to just flour. You know, I want eggs and this and that and that and that. So in terms of my own academic interest, it's been pretty wide. I guess a diplomat. Between all of these different areas of study, not only within natural building, but then starting to get interested in community design and climate change and healthy building. And how does one create a clean village using all of these ideas that I've come across over the years? And how do we combine things together to make an effective system of living moving forward that replaces the modernist, you know, machine for living, you know, which was very mechanistic and built around the factory model, you know.
And extractive.
extractive, not really supportive of human, the human biome, if you will.
Which contributes to physical and mental health.
Yeah, mental health, physical health, social health, it's all connected. And so where can we impact things? It's like, okay, we have to start with ourselves, you know, so we can, you know, take care of our eating and eat organic and stuff. But as you say, our buildings, we can consider them as our third skin. You know, our we have our actual skin, and then we have our clothes, which are our second skin. And then we have the third skin, which is our house or buildings that we're in. And so if we start to think of those as an organ and how to make it as healthy as possible, that then is a way to lead us forward to creating healthy places to live. And then the fourth skin is then the biosphere itself.
Yes.
And so how do we improve the functioning of the planet through how we work as well?
Exactly. Exactly. So the whole idea of having a village that is, you know, third skin housing, that where you are also integrating farming techniques and permaculture techniques so that you're eating high density, high nutrient density food. This whole project of creating a village that is not just clean, but active microbiome, this is regenerative. And we just had this amazing conversation the other day with Peter Coughlin from Regen Ventures, who was talking about village designs as carbon neutral or carbon negative. How do you think about that?
Well, I don't use the word sustainable anymore because that's not good enough. We've damaged so much of the biosphere and everything. We need to build it back again. And so this idea of regenerative or restorative development has been of main interest. I don't like to say negative, or I like to say net positive. That's how I like to look at it. So how do we make things that are net positive energy, net positive social good, net positive food, net positive habitat, net positive water? You know, how do we, you know, work with collecting things and conserving them and keeping them available and be part of a systematic way of doing this that adds to the biosphere and increases its viability?
That's it. That's this whole emphasis on really understanding that this is all, these are all elements in very integrated systems. And to isolate any one of them, you're just getting away from the truth. And what was so interesting about this conversation with Peter Coughlin, and I hope he can be a guest on this podcast in the future, he said he would, was the reality that carbon credits is something that is a commodity now in the extractive economy. And the extractive economy only likes simplicity of the outcomes from one project with one intention and is not good at seeing the systemic and the interrelatedness of everything. And so the carbon negative approach is basically a way of like connecting with the extractive economy with a commodity. So it's a way of like commodifying the regeneration systems that are what we really need. But it's an olive leaf to the way the economy is set up now.
Well, I think it's going to be a both and situation because we obviously have 8 billion people now, and we have created a situation where we need to sustain that population in a way that allows for people to survive, ideally. Otherwise, we're just going to descend into planetary chaos. And I'm an optimist. I feel that we can apply ourselves through systems thinking, really, because it's more efficient, really. An environment, an ecosystem is a system. And we, thinking that way, can take advantage of advantages that are maybe not entirely clear, or symbiotic relationships that lead to efficiencies. And by crossing boundaries, we can create hybrids that can have extra benefit beyond the addition of the two things together. And so by thinking that way is a creative way of moving forward and leading to something that can be robust and resilient, because we not only need to restore, we need to be resilient to the bad things that are increasingly happening, you know? And so we have to be, I call it ruggedization. That is the word that I've coined now, is we need to make everything just totally, literally bomb-proof sometimes, you know, in terms of the effects of winds and fires and hurricanes and tornadoes and everything. You know, we need to be, you know, durability is the new green, you know, and old is the new green, you know, and there's a certain way of rethinking things now that we have to address that is incredibly exciting in some ways in terms of the creative challenge that it poses, but also pretty dire in terms of like, we have to figure this stuff out.
That's right. Yeah. I think that's really kind of, it's right now is the moment, like you're talking about durability and the typical affordable housing in this country now is trailers that are designed to last no more than 30 years. They are designed for obsolescence. And when people live in them longer than 30 years, which they almost always do, they get sick.
And the alternative, as you mentioned before, though, is right in front of us. You know, there's a 1,000-year-old adobe house right up the state from us that, as you say, has been lived in all this time. Mm-hmm. And they constantly can remodel it and they add to it. And, you know, it can be lived in an evolving sort of way. And that's the wonderful aspect of earth building, too, is that
it's alive.
It's alive. It can grow. It can evolve. It can be part of you. And that's what I think is the attraction to them. The older buildings are just so compelling just because you can really feel that life in them. Mm,
really true. How many, like what percentage would you say we live in a town of about 15,000 people. What percentage would you say are old adobes in this town?
It's hard to know sometimes because sometimes they get covered over. Mm. And so you don't really know what's inside of there. And I know Silver City itself, though, was actually more of a brick city. They actually made it so that most of the buildings here had to be made out of brick. So Silver City is unique in that regard. But in the Membrés Valley, for example, you know, you can find old adobes there. In the rural regions, they're quite common, or were. And you can even see ruins, you know, to this day, mm-hmm. you know, because once the roof goes in, it will melt back to the earth again, mm-hmm. which is the beauty and the challenge of earth building, mm-hmm. is it does need to be protected.
And maintained, yeah.
But if they does,
are, I mean, we see in San Lorenzo, for example, you can see buildings that are 100, 150 yeah. years old.
And there's no reason why, if it's protected, the old saying is give it a good hat and a good pair of boots and a coat that breathes, mm-hmm. and it should last forever. Right. And that's saying a good roof that can protect it from the rain, mm-hmm. and also from the rain splash. So that's why overhangs are important yeah. for earth buildings. Mm-hmm. And then having a foundation that raises that earth above the ground, because the biggest enemy is water. Mm-hmm. And the wicking water from the ground into the walls can be the most damaging, in fact. So having a solid foundation. So it's fairly simple, but you know, it's amazing how often the simple things don't get really looked at.
This is it. I mean, and this leads me to this one. So I have a lot of friends who are builders. One of my dearest friends is named Michael, and he lives in San Lorenzo. He's a builder. And he built his house about 15 years ago. And it's a conventionally built, stick-built house, but very high level attention to detail. He's meticulous. So he has, you know, 16-ounce center, 2x6s as the roof. And he has metal roofing, but with screws, not the standing seam. And he had a leak in his house. And he's 77 years old now. And last time I was there, I said, did you figure out that leak? He said, yep. I said, how many times did you have to go up on the roof? He said, 11 times. I said, what was it? He said, one screw that had worked its way out a quarter turn. And I thought, what a great example of how meticulous you need to be to keep a stick-built house from going bad.
Well, any house from going bad, frankly, it's something that you're bringing a point to, that maintenance and how we interact with our buildings is really important. And when it's just a commodity, they're not thought of as something to be maintained.
That's right.
And that's when we get the issues of poor design with neglect equals mold, equals leaking, equals these issues that have affected so many people, as you've mentioned.
This is it. And this is something I want to get back to, this idea of like the systems and understanding the mechanism of action. So when you're systems thinking about like, you know, your environment, your microenvironment as your home, as your third skin, understanding the mechanism of action is incredibly important. And that's one of the things that you have to do if you get incredibly sick and have to get better, because when people get sick in a way that's chronic, our conventional Western medical system doesn't really handle that well. And more often than not, they will gaslight patients, especially if they're women, and say, you know, we can't find anything wrong with you, so would you like an antidepressant? So what you end up doing is having to go on your own to figure out what the mechanisms of action are in your own body that are malfunctioning. And so, and this is one of the things that I have been unusually good at in figuring out for myself, and I help clients figure out. So for example, when I got sick and I became bedridden 7 years ago, I stopped sleeping, and I could see very clearly that there was an endocrine disruption that was happening. And I went to an endocrinologist, was told that all of my labs were normal, et cetera, et cetera. So I had to biohack this myself and started to understand how the endocrine system works, how the glands work with each other, how the system works. And so it's the same for a human body as it is for a house and for a community. If you understand the mechanism of action, like the hormonal impact on insomnia, for example, it's the same for a house. You understand a leak can lead to mold in a cavity of your roof if you have, for example, 2x6 wooden beams. But what people don't understand now, and this is something that is making this natural building much more mandatory for people to recover their health, is that the microbial world is changing a lot, in especially in the last 40 years, since the early 70s. There's just antifungals in our house paint, antifungals that are sprayed on agricultural fields. And what that means is the fungi are mutating, just like the bacteria are mutating in like MRSA in hospitals. Viruses are mutating, obviously, clearly. Parasites, all of the microbes are mutating. And what that means is that the toxins that we are exposed to now, it's not just the chemicals, it's not just the 80,000 plus chemicals that are now in our environment that were not in our grandparents' environment. It's that the microbes are trying to clean them up. And when they try to do that, they metabolize them and create their own chemicals, which are called biotoxins. And those can be extremely dangerous in a way that our conventional medical system is not aware of. So again, this is systems thinking. When you understand that your macro environment, your micro environment, your clothes, your skin, and the internal environment in your body are all extremely complex microbiomes, and you start to understand the mechanism of action of how it works, then you can design a healthy life.
Well, that as you're speaking, reminds me of the early days of the natural building movement, which was in many cases driven by people with environmental illness. They were the canaries in the coal mine with our society in terms of its health. And through necessity, as you just mentioned, they were drawn to non-toxic materials in every aspect of their lives, including their houses. And so it was fascinating that that is how I started to learn about it. And that's, and I, there's a system called Baubiologie, which is a German system of building health that became introduced to the conversation, and others who started to study health in building. And so slowly we started to see that, oh, this is why people are getting sick. Well, first, why is it happening? And then, oh, this is what we could do about it. We're noticing that when we just use pure earth, people are really liking that. If we don't use the high VOC paints, the volatile organic compound paints, people aren't as sensitive. If we can reduce dust, if we can make sure that we have a proper temperature modulation, you know, quality of the heat that we have, the quality of the light. You know, health is way more than just sensitivity to mold or anything like that. It's it has so many aspects to it. And so, but something that I became aware of, but then more and more I've realized that I myself have probably been exposed to a lot of stuff myself, and I need personally to be healed through my building. And so when it's like the architect's, kids go shoeless sort of thing. It's like, how do I need to personally improve my health and my environment? Because I'm not living in an earthen house right now. I'm living in an older apartment. And it's sort of like, okay.
But it's brick and plaster. It's amazing.
Well, it shows you that old can be healthy because it's off-gassed already. And it was built out of the stuff from those days. And it's also why it's important to save those old materials too. And reuse them. Because, there's been a lot of advances that some of the most onerous and bad stuff is not being used as much anymore. Like formaldehyde, for example.
It's everywhere.
But still, there's stuff that we don't even aren't aware of having an impact on us. So it's sort of better to play it safe in this regard. And the nice thing, though, is it's evolved so much over the last 20 years or so, I'd say, from when it really began back in the mid-90s, in terms of people really beginning to adopt it as a profession. And now people are really starting to know what they're doing. And they have made a lot of mistakes over the last 20 years and a lot of poorly designed buildings. Just because it's natural doesn't mean it's good. You still have to make sure that you use proper techniques and building science is appropriate. I mean, there's a little bit too much magical thinking in the natural building world, in my mind.
It's interesting that you say that. The topic of straw bales is going to come up next, I think.
Well, yeah, and I think there's a certain naivete that people have around it and a certain enthusiasm that people get that can kind of drive rationality out of their minds. And so for me, I've been trying to find the happy balance between taking advantage of our conventional civilization and everything that it brings to us, mm-hmm. and the wisdom of the ancients and what they learned and how do we merge those things now. And find a medium where we can live in ways that we want to live into the future and not try and fit ourselves into a past box,
and not dictate our actions now based on the status quo.
Right. And really be fresh in our thinking and really start from the basics and say, okay, here's our ingredients. Well, first, here are our needs. We need to be healthy human beings. We need to have that physical health, mental health, social health. How do we achieve that? We can look around at the research and say, okay, we can biophilic design really seems to be a way to go. Having life-affirming environments, it's kind of obvious, but, that's what it comes down to. And what are the ingredients to that? We can talk about that more. But it's basically a new way of thinking and approaching a problem as opposed to a business economy driver being human health as the driver. It's a whole different set of ideas that comes out of that.
And it's a whole different wealth too. So when you're talking about the business model, wanting to get profits for shareholders, in this model, the biophilic design model, the shares are increased health and happiness.
And then societal health, because that's right. Looking around, say, for this county, our county of Grant County here in New Mexico, there's a lot of issues. I mean, and they're longstanding, poverty, teenage pregnancy, societal ills that.
And
chronic illness. A lot of people that have not been exposed to, or had advantages to make healthy choices, are suffering. And so, but yet also too, though, there's a tradition of living close to the earth. And there is a sense that we have assets here that if we bring them together, we could actually create a model of that's quite powerful that other communities could also emulate. And that's kind of what I'm thinking now. It's like, I've been studying this stuff now for 40 years. I've been looking at it from the energy standpoint, from the water standpoint, from the habitat, from the
cultural,
all of it because of it, the systems nature of what we're talking about, but also my interests are systemic. And so I went and bucked the system, really, which drives us to specialization. That's one of the biggest downsides of, I think, of our culture, is we are encouraged to put blinders on. And if you don't, you're kind of, you know, you're thought of as a dilettante or a jack of all trades or something like that.
Yeah, this is pointing to a paradigm shift that's going to be inevitable. This kind of mental framework that is the building blocks of our extractive economy, where we're focusing on one project and one profit from a single, basically isolating things that are not isolated. They are all interconnected. We're just ignoring that fact.
But when you start to bring in new economic models and new ways of owning land and ways to deal with transportation, how to have food available, how to even have healthcare, you know, if you start to rethink our typical American way of doing things, which is like get in the car and go to the store, we can invent new types of societal aids for ourselves. And we can be part of our society. I don't agree with creating things that are completely apart, because then how can people learn from it? Because I think all of our societies go this way.
Okay, so not the eco village that's going to be off in the wilderness by itself.
No, it's more like the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, okay. The neighborhood that's actually working and people want to be in there. And it's not like necessarily even having to advertise itself. I think part of the problem with a lot of the natural building stuff is kind of a earnest preachiness that can kind of get in the way of attracting kind of regular folks to what we're trying to talk about.
Okay.
And so much of it is around the language that you use, your attitude, mm-hmm. you know, not demonizing people for their choices, because a lot of it's from ignorance, really, mm-hmm. and not having a choice on the other hand. And so,
absolutely. I just want to mention, like, I had a conversation the other day with someone, said, it's, you know, it's my own fault. And I said, well, you know, there's this rugged individualism that is promulgated as a sort of an archetype in America, where, you know, there's a lot of individual responsibility and rights. But it doesn't, it really, it's intentionally promulgated, because it really takes the frame of reference off the systems thinking. And there are systems that are stacked against the working people in this country that to shift, so that people can have an easier time of it, have less debt, have more education, have higher quality food, have higher quality family time, have cleaner environments. Like, the movement is now. It's so clear that this needs to happen. One of the things that I wanted to say was, I am amazed that it took me 7 years to hear the word salutogenic design. Can you talk a little bit about that? You wrote a paper about that.
Yes, that was a fancy word for health promoting design. Mm-hmm. So something that enables us to work better. So as I mentioned earlier, so the quality of light, for example, like reducing glare and stress on our eyes, can make us feel more comfortable in our visual way. That our olfactory environment, is something stinky and smelly, or is there a nice, fresh, you know, or smell to the air?
Or no smell.
Or no smell.
That's nice.
And things like that, you know, the even like the subtlety of the touch, you know, the haptic realm, the sense of touch, you know, touching an earthen wall, it just has a different quality than touching, you know, something, you know, painted with, absolutely, you know, on drywall. And so to me, there's a certain, also, how should I say, to consider these as aesthetic pleasures, I feel like we've been starved in many ways aesthetically as humans from the wonders of the natural world. You know, the artificial world is really a dumbed down version materially of that.
It has a neural impact on your brain.
We don't have as much of a sophisticated environment that feeds our brain. And so that's why I think there's a big desire to have some of the organic forms, even as part of that. Sometimes that's where I find myself in my hybrid mind, because I am of this world. I'm not going to go back to the Iron Age somewhere and live with just a jar and a straw pallet. You know, I have a queen size bed, mm-hmm. and I have cabinets. And I think to acknowledge that we live the way we do now, but how do we do it in a way that's, you know, in tune with how we lived in the past? And so it's kind of the best of both worlds, because I don't like some of these designs that are so custom that what, it takes 10 years to finish the darn thing because you're having to custom make every little piece. You know, that becomes kind of elitist, frankly.
So what do you think about the Cobb house that we just built in 2 months?
I think it was good. The reason I liked it was that it was a simple form. You did a rectangular form, which made it easier to make a roof, because roofing materials become increasingly challenged to deal with the farther you go away from a rectilinear form. You use basic solar design to have it be absorbing the sunlight when you want and blocking it when you don't. You made it so it could collect water, that you could connect solar panels to it easily, that it could be built of the earth from the land for the most part, that could be done with labor that you had at hand and was available and doable by those people. Those were all positive ingredients to that building to me. And it's a robust set of ingredients too.
One of the things that I liked about it was the location was so fresh and clean and beautiful and tree lovely, like beautiful pine. It's Pinus altus, which means tall pine. And that smell of like clean, mossy, minerally smell that you get in a clean forest, that was the soil that we built the walls out of. And the plaster. I just love that. And well, for me, having like still having extreme environmental sensitivities, for me to work on that house where I was rasping the walls and getting dust in my lungs, like I was literally, not only was I not worrying about getting drywall dust in my lungs, I was thinking, wow, the dust that I am creating by doing this work right now is actually increasing the diversity of the biome in my lungs. Like it actually felt good.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't recommend having a lot of dust in your lungs of whatever kind, but it's interesting. But you know, it's funny as you bring it up, though, is I feel like building out in a natural area as we have here is really a luxury, and not many people have it. And so for me, I'd rather, instead of going into nature and building something within deep nature, is how do we bring the nature back to the cities? Okay. And how do we heal the city? And how do we bring, you know, little bit by little bit, these healing cells into the cities to eventually take it over and make the entire city a healthy place to be?
I really appreciate that point of view. And that is a point of view that would prevent problems and integrate, like, you know, the salutogenic design elements into society so that people's health gets better. When someone has already gotten sick, like the person that we built this house for, it's too late.
Right.
Like you need the cleanest possible environment for people like that. But I really appreciate this vision of creating a micro village as a, with systems design that is for regular people, a neighborhood.
I think it's a both and sort of situation because of their need. Folks like your client and others are pioneering and are creating new ways of doing things out of their need. And we can learn a lot from that. And that's what I think the natural building environment has been about, has been learning from each other. And it's been coming from a lot of different directions, like the health promoting aspect, but then the environmental aspect of how do we do something that's good for planetary health. Then the do-it-yourself, mortgage-free movement, the economic empowerment out of it. Then just the overall fun and community building and just the attractiveness of the act of building using these materials to me has just been incredibly healing, to the point where I think every city should have dedicated a block to just mud land where people could just go and there's just a mud pit going 24/7 and you could just get in there and make your mush and do something and make a blob. And you know, I think that would probably be the most healing, wonderful thing for any city in the world.
I love that idea. Another conversation that I've had recently was with a man named Adam Screnzi, who's been the Center for Infrastructure and Society. And one of his projects is about improving the health culture at a construction site, which I thought was really interesting. I hope to get him on this podcast.
Yeah, it's pretty toxic. I mean, there's a funny story, though. I know that you probably don't like jawbells very much, but it was part of the natural building world and a big thing that I was involved in there for a while. But I worked on a straw bale winery in California, and we were working there at the same time as the framing crew. And the contrast between the two crews was pretty hilarious, because the framing crew was total type A, F this, F that, you know, super like metal music, doing yoga beforehand, and you know, had a couple of Nepalese workers, and you know, the girl with green hair, you know, it was like so funny. And you know, we had our like organic coffee that we had, and it was just so, but it was like such a nicer way of doing construction, you know, and that agro vibe, it goes into the buildings, I'm convinced, you know?
Oh, it's just like cooking. Absolutely. You can feel it in the food.
Yeah. And so when we think of our houses, they need to be, like you say, like food. You know, a house should be like a good meal that for our whole lives in terms of how it supports us, makes us feel.
This is really important to me. So the culture that we had on the building site for building this little tiny adobe house that we just finished was so high vibe. Like, it was so fun to be there. And so everybody felt respected. Everybody, there was healing that was happening there. And then I'm sorry you missed the final banquet that we had, but we had this super high vibration, like vegan buffet that was cooked by some friends of ours. And just so much love and appreciation for each other. I was really just so, so grateful for what the crew brought, what each person brought, their talents, and just the whole project was just amazing.
Well, the building sometimes for a certain reason, mm-hmm. but what happens is the social aspect is so overwhelmingly positive. That's what to me seems to be the biggest impact of it, frankly, wow. is what you actually say. I would teach natural building workshops a number of years ago, sometimes extended ones, like a week or 2 weeks or something like that. And what I quickly realized that people thought they were coming in for a technical workshop, but it was more of a life-changing therapy for them. And, you know, usually like day four, like somebody would have some major breakdown or breakthrough. And so I realized that having agency and connection through a healing thing that's so important for us, you know, creating our own housing, what's more primal than that? Mm-hmm. And to have a sense of connection with that, and not only a connection at all, but one that's life affirming and fun and society, it's like how we should be
exactly.
as human beings. Exactly. It's just like, oh man. And when you hit it and you feel it, it's like, there's nothing better. And so, and having that provide a human need, it's like, oh my gosh, it's like, that's what gives me hope, is how much we realize we need it once we're in it.
Mm. Yeah. And, yeah. I really feel this sense of being grounded in wholeness, having the creation process come through this feeling of wholeness and joy. That's what's happening for me. And that's what seems like it's happening for other people.
And if we could replicate that and make it more available to others and find ways to take advantage of our systems that we do have and improve them to provide this type of experience, this type of product for people, mm-hmm. that's how I'd like to be moving forward with this work, because everything else seems a waste of time, frankly.
I hear it. So, yeah. So it is amazing, again, to me, like, okay, this connection between natural building and people who are chemically sensitive is 40 years old. And it's amazing to me that this isn't more common knowledge, that people don't know this.
Well, like you say, there's been a big pushback. You know, people are thought to be psychological about it. You know, that, you know, there's a lot of these sort of mystery ailments that I think are environmentally driven, many of them, that are subtle in terms of how they came to be. And as you mentioned, the medical system's not designed to address some of these things that are emerging. And so we've had to kind of, through research and just pure experience, like, okay, living in an adobe house makes you feel better than not living in one. And I don't know why, but it is. So just practical experience is driving this too.
Absolutely.
And so I think we're at a point, though, that the science is coming together with enough practical experience, plus the need is just so extreme from all directions that, and we do know enough now. I mean, I feel like finally we're getting to the point where we're beyond the initial prototyping, and a lot of people have been working a long time, and I think it's just time to put it all together.
I agree. All right. So let's talk. First of all, welcome to the board of Crooked Forest Institute.
Well, thank
you, Jim Kennedy. We're so happy to have you on it. I'm just going to take a minute to talk about what our focus is right now.
Great.
So it is an institute. The idea is to create a school that will systematize the building of Adobe tiny houses, more or less, so that there are people who specialize in whatever it is that they are drawn to. So it might be Cobb, it might be Adobe, it might be compressed earth block, it might be Earthbag. I'm thinking we will have four house designs that people who would like to live in one of these neighborhoods would be able to choose. And then when these houses are being built, there is input and sweat equity from the owners to be part of the school, at least initially. I think the houses that we create will probably be made available to the students first. And then essentially what we're trying to do is create a reproducible neighborhood design. So we're looking at least 10 small, 300 to 600 square foot Adobe tiny houses with shared infrastructure. So each one of these houses could, if they wanted to have a kitchen and a bathroom in the house and they can afford it, they would put one in. But if they didn't want one or didn't have the money for it at that time, they could use the communal infrastructure, because the communal infrastructure of the kitchen dining building, the bathroom building, and then they'll build like a makerspace building plus the garden will be on a community land trust. So this will be, at least in one of the models, private equity owned Adobe houses that people can own the house, but they don't own the land underneath it. The land is held in a community land trust, which makes it affordable for generations. So what I am envisioning is that the result of Crooked Forest Institute will be graduates who have specialties. One specialty will be building. One specialty will be water catchment. The third will be systems optimization. So designing systems so that they are reproducible and most efficient, so that these houses go up in the most efficient, safe, and affordable way. And then the final one is financial specialists that can help other communities develop the community land trust model and build a whole neighborhood from scratch. And once the first one is done, the second one is easy.
I think that looking at the models that are working already well and then adopting the best practices that are out there is a wise way to go. And it sounds like that's been the approach so far. Because there is, you know, why reinvent the wheel? And there are actually quite a lot of really good, innovative systems that are evolving in these other ways, like
absolutely,
the financial sphere, yep, and the education and training. Mm-hmm. And so that's what gives me hope, is yeah, that people have been working behind the scenes tirelessly, actually, for a long time on all these different things, and they're beginning to actually work it out.
Yeah, they really are. And I want to mention a couple that are role models for us. One is called Square One Villages in Oregon. They have five different projects going. Some of them are like emergency housing for homeless people, but some are just lower income people that want to live on a community land trust. They also do a cooperative model on the land trust so that it's not just a community land trust. It's also all of the housing is held in a cooperative so that there's money, so that they're all maintained really well and someone can buy in and be an owner for, you know, $10,000 rather than the owned shared equity model, which is, you know, you're owning your own house by yourself and you're taking on that whole debt, which I'm still expecting would be under $100,000. So there is no model that is like this. So Square One Villages in Oregon, and then Newtown CDC, which is a community development corporation in Tempe, Arizona, I think it's near Phoenix. That also is a community land trust model. They have a tiny house village. It's conventionally stick built, but there's small footprint, and that's already working. And then, you know, one of the biggest role models is Community Rebuilds in Moab, Utah. They're doing amazing work creating a community land trust where owner builders are helping to build their own houses. They are doing mostly straw bales, and I just want to mention why that is not something that we're interested in. I'm connected. I'm a partner member of ICI, which is the International Society for Environmentally Acquired Illnesses. And one of the co-founding doctors, Dr. Ackerley, Mary Ackerley, things that she said to me was, the sickest people I see are from straw bales in New Mexico. So that story that I talked about the quarter turn in the screw that was working itself out of my friend Michael's house, it's not that straw bales aren't okay. It's that they can go bad so quickly and so catastrophically that it's not worth putting the effort into it if you have the genetics or the vulnerability for biotoxin illness. So that's why we're not considering it as one of the designs that we are looking at.
It's so interesting to see as you learn more and more about things, and then, you know, something can make it a deal breaker. And so I'm continuing to learn all the time about all of these things. But I think a few basics are emerging. Mm-hmm. And if you get those right, you know, you can get yourself 80% there. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of how I'm trying to operate these days. It's like, let's try and get like 80% good.
Okay.
And just so that we can do it. Because if you try to go over 100%, it's just like
it stops
zero. You.
Right.
You know, and I'd rather have 80% than zero.
I love it. I like the momentum. And that was the attitude I had with the house that I'm living in right now, which is a brick garage that I created into a house that I could live in. It has almost no wood in the living space. And, you know, definitely not perfect, but it's fine. It's awesome.
And I think that keeping things simple, though, and finding ways to make it easier is always good. And that's why I'm not against actually mechanization and even factory built, because in many ways, especially with building, you could be more efficient and more healthy and less wasteful if you created a dedicated factory. My interest now is to make it so that it's not so actually physically hard, because now that you've made a bunch of cob by hand, it's hard on your body.
It's really hard.
You know, and so there's machines are nice for certain things. And so I'm trying to find that balance between the advantages that we have from machines like backhoes and stuff and our own smart brains, and then finding ways to combine those things most efficiently and effectively so that we can just get a net positive benefit out of the end.
I agree.
And shift things gradually away from the way we are, but we're not going to radically do it. So little bit by little bit, and fix what we've got as best we can, deconstruct what's just not going to work, reconstruct using that stuff to the best that we can, sequester the yucky stuff, mm-hmm. you know, in ways that it can be at least controlled.
I really like this balance of like moving forward, but not being obsessed about perfection, just trying to get it to right. be where it's good enough, but also having a radically open mind for how to create these solutions in the future. Like, we need to be creative. We need to be open-minded. We need to be innovative in terms of creating new solutions that are really going to work for the largest amount of people. And that, you know, I always say, like, I'm really into vicarious learning. I love when I find someone who's already figured it out and is doing it really well. And I especially love vicarious failing when I find that, you know, something hasn't worked well. I really like that.
Okay. Well, you can learn a lot from me then.
All right.
So, yeah. yeah. And that's one of the side, I wouldn't call it benefits, but effects of being a pioneer is you fail a lot. Mm-hmm. But you learn a lot too, because you learn a lot more from failure than you do from success.
Hell yes, you do. There's no other way to become resilient.
And it also just makes you more, if you keep going though, it's like, okay, patience is totally a virtue. And one of the things that I've learned is that you can achieve way more in 20 years than you think that you can. And if you're patient and you stick to it and you just don't stop. And then it becomes the paradigm eventually. And so that's one of the things is that this has been a generational change that's had to happen. Several generations change because construction is a very conservative business, in fact. And so making these sorts of changes takes a long time. But I think creating viable, replicable models is the key thing. And being here in Grant County is, I think, in an ideal place in many ways to do this sort of prototyping because the need is here. There's the possibility. It's kind of more fertile ground than a lot of places are in terms of being able to do it at all.
What do you think it's specifically good about Grant County that's going to sort of lend itself to this project succeeding?
Well, there's space. There's people who have background in earth building here. Mm-hmm. There's a tradition of it here. So there's something to kind of link into from the past. There's just land, you know, you can do it. There's dirt, you know, there's a certain rural possibility than trying to do it in the middle of, say, Los Angeles or something. And there's the need, you know, and it's quite extreme need and a need that could be addressed by this idea and a place that I think has the assets plus the needs plus the potential of getting it done because of the energy of some of the community here that to me is ripe. And if you can get something that could be up and running and going in a way that is moderately successful, you know, it's like, okay, you can tune the carburetor later,
right?
Just get the engine going.
That's
and
right.
So that to me is kind of what I'm seeing now is we need to have something where we can actually see and show and say, this is what we're talking about.
This is it. Yeah.
It's not just some pie in the sky, you know, hippie vision.
It's a
real nutsy boltsy thing.
I want a three-dimensional campus that I can show people like, yeah. These are our 10 buildings. These are our 4 designs. This is how it looks. This is how it works.
Yeah.
Let's do another one.
Yeah, and I think that if that could be designed as an empowering educational system. So one of the ideas that I've had, because I got into the community stuff again through the tiny house world because of mostly affordable housing, and that was where I was approaching it most recently was this idea that if you build small out of whatever, and I wasn't thinking about the health concern as much, but more just the economic concern. Mm-hmm. But then having a bunch of isolated little tiny houses around isn't that viable either. So this idea of tiny house villages was of great interest and research for me. And in many ways, what you're talking about is very similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really a tiny house, but...
It is the house that we just created was 240 square feet, but had a 500 square foot roof. So one of the rooms was intended to be outdoors.
So, so that your building that you just made definitely fits within that criteria.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter whether it's 120 square feet or 300. I mean, it's not your 3000 square foot typical dumb giant house. That's way too much expense.
I'm so frustrated with the fact that all of the subdivisions in the area and probably all around the country have square foot minimums that are 1300 square feet, 1500 square feet. To me, that seems like unethical to build a house that big now.
Well, you're right. And it's interesting to see where the places where are holding us back. And a lot of it's zoning.
Right.
Getting into like the wiring underneath the board of things and understanding how zoning can drive everything, things like setbacks and height limits and what you're just saying, parking restrictions, stuff like that. And so that's where we need to push against that sort of stuff best to find, the areas of possibility within which exists. So pushing the envelope is best to start with and then changing the law when you have to. A little civil disobedience doesn't hurt.
Okay.
Just to kind of force the issue sometimes. Mm-hmm. Though that's a risky way to go.
I'm not into confrontation, but innovation needs to happen. So we'll just wade into the water and see how that works.
And I think when you invite the officials in, if you make a good faith effort to address their concerns, which are around life safety primarily.
First, legitimate.
And that then helps you go a long way. And if you have somebody, if you're like dealing with a building official, if you can find a building official from another jurisdiction that's familiar with this sort of stuff, that can be your ally, okay, that is super helpful. And
what do you mean building, like an inspector?
Yeah, somebody who's, say, approved a Cobb building or an earth building,
okay,
in another jurisdiction who's gone through it already.
I see.
And let's say your building inspector is feeling kind of unsure.
Okay.
They trust each other a lot more than they trust you.
Oh.
And so if you can get somebody who can vouch for what you're doing, that can be super helpful.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, New Mexico has its own earth and building code as of 2015. It has its own tiny house code also. I'm not sure what the date on that is, like 2018 maybe?
Well, between the tradition that's here and some of the forward thinking of our state, which is why I'm here, mm-hmm, in many ways, is because the vision is evolving and there, but the history is there. And the people who are interested in this type of thing are drawn here. So those three things together, to me, look to be a positive environment for innovation.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm here, is because I want to get things done. I want to see it happen. There's enough talks and papers and books. We have enough of that now. We just need to have the models on the ground and people living in them so they can show how awesome it is.
Right on. So let's get it done.
That's right.
Right on. All right. So we're going to finish this off by pointing you to our website, crookedforestinstitute.org, to find out more information. We're going to have a natural building slam in the spring. So join our mailing list to find out more about that. That's going to be 10 speakers, 10 minutes, 10 slides each. Are you going to be a speaker at that, Jeff?
Sure.
Right on. Let's get it done.
All right.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Wonderful conversation.
Yeah, that was terrific.
All right. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Holly.
Thanks, Jeff.